Chief Justice.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
Our opinion next turns to the problem of what the judicial role should be.
I had a picture of him as in the 80s, and he was a big, strong, weightlifting guy. And then when he passed away, he was kind of a little skinny old man.
This is Life of the Law. I'm Nancy Mullane. Douglas Collier is serving a life sentence inside San Quentin State Prison. For years, he shared a 9-by-4-foot cell, 36 square feet, with his friend Tony, another inmate. Then Tony got sick. He couldn't stop coughing. His arteries were clogged. Months later, Tony died, one of hundreds of inmates who die in California prisons each year. In this episode of Life of the Law, Douglas tells us what it's like to witness and come to terms with his friend's death. Our story was produced by Greg Eskridge, an inmate and journalist with the San Quentin Prison Report.
So one day, right before institutional count, 4 o'clock count, he was really quiet that day. He didn't really say a whole lot, which wasn't unusual. I mean, it's not like we were chattered all the time or anything. And he was laying down, and it was count time. The cop came by and wanted me standing and wanted him to stand too. And I gave Tony a little shake because the cop says, hey, have him stand. And he didn't respond. So immediately I shook him again, and the guy knew what was up. He knew that there was something wrong. And so did I, but I wasn't gonna say anything. You know, in those situations, it's kind of, you know, you just kind of let things unfold. But I knew that something was definitely wrong. So the cop hit his button. The lieutenant came around and was yelling up there, get a gurney up there, or, you know, those plastic buckets that they carry people in. And it wasn't probably 30 seconds. The bar pulled open, cop told me to step out, they cuffed me up. And immediately walked me straight over to C-section and locked me in the cage for hours. And I kind of knew that he had passed, you know.
I met Tony Ogle here in 1991. We used to work in a hobby shop together. He was a really fun guy to be around, and he had a couple of kids, I think two boys, and then he kept kind of close contact with his mom. And I asked Tony, I says, hey, you want to move in together? A lot of times if somebody's your good friend, you really don't want to live with them. You don't, because it just ruins a relationship. It's like we're best of friends outside the cell. But when you move in with somebody, it takes on a different dynamic if the two guys are not really compatible. He was really a really private person, but, you know, we were so close that I felt like he opened up to me more than he would with anybody else. And he come from a real old school way of thinking in prison. You know, he was here in the late 70s, early 80s, where it was a much more violent and brutal place to do time. Here, Folsom, you know, he ran with a pretty tough crowd. So he had definitely, you know, been down the river a time or two. So it was that, so to speak. So he was like an old, grizzled old guy. I think the closest thing that I could identify him too would be, they had a couple guys on Lonesome Dove, really, really good buddies, but they weren't like real lovey-dovey or real caring, and they didn't talk about really, you know, a lot of emotions and stuff like that, or family, but there was a lot of love there, you know what I mean? It was just kind of an unspoken thing where, you know, in that movie, one of them drugged the other guy's dead body after he finally passed away, you know, across a couple states to bury him exactly where he wanted to be buried. Anyway, that was, he was that kind of a person, and our relationship was that way. As men in prison, we, you know, we're not big on, you know, showing any weakness at all or having any sympathy for anyone at all. And of course those things are not true, but we never let any of that stuff on, and that's, you know, kind of how we get through. So we lived over in East Block for a while. After a while, I noticed that he was having a hard time walking. This is like years later. And he's one of these guys where he wouldn't call a man down if he was dying of a heart attack. I mean, he just wasn't a doctor and kind of, you know, never let on when you're sick, never let nobody see you cry. He was really having some trouble. And he wasn't a complainer, so I knew that there was something wrong, but I didn't really think it was anything that bad. And he went to the doctor, and they immediately scheduled him for angioplasty, I think they call it, when they blow your veins up and open them up so you can get some better circulation. So they did that, and he came back. But within like 2 days, he's up, back to his old ways, you know, going to the hobby shop, laughing and joking, we're smoking, and just normal stuff. It wasn't long after that he got really sick, and he had been coughing for like a year or so, and I used to always get on him, "Hey, quit with that hacking, man, you gotta hack all the time, man." But he was having a hard time breathing. I could tell that something was not right. And of course, he kept smoking and, you know, all that. He didn't, again, like, you know, we don't listen to anything as men. We learn everything the hard way. And he'd rather just die in his bed. And he said that, you know, enough times. "When I go, man, don't be calling nobody. Just let me get up out of here. I won't have to stand and count no more." Back then, they weren't letting anybody out. Lifers were not going home anyway. He knew that chances of him going home were pretty slim. A couple days before he actually passed, it was getting close to Halloween, he started to become really distant and disconnected. He didn't hardly speak, and this was way unusual. I knew something was wrong, but he was the kind of guy I couldn't force to go do anything. He couldn't really talk. He was like incoherent, and there wasn't a whole bunch I could do about that. I had a picture of him as in the 80s, and he was a big, strong, weightlifting guy. And then when he passed away, he was kind of a little skinny old man. It's just completely different, you know, all white hair, real sharp features, you know, cheekbones sticking out. And the pictures that I had from him younger, he was just young, really long hair, didn't even look like the same guy at all. I felt the loss for sure, but I was just kind of numb about it. And I've always known that if your bunkie died in prison, at least in California, whether there was any obvious trauma or anything like that at all, you were going to the hole until the autopsy came back and cleared you of any wrongdoing. So it's basically you're treated like you're guilty until proven not guilty. And I kind of knew that I was in for a stay when they walked me over there. You know, you hear the door clanking and you walk in there, and you know, it's not just, you're not going over there for
any kind of interrogation or anything. You're going over there to, because they got to do what they got to do. I finally got a cell. Of course, it was filthy and kind of disgusting. You're lucky if you got a set of sheets, you know, and a blanket. No pillow, just all really, just really cold and punishing. I mean, that's the best way I can put it. You go from a mainline situation to the whole situation. It's pretty drastic change. No soap, no nothing to clean with. So you're kind of creeped out over there. You don't want to touch a whole bunch of stuff, but I mean, you're stuck in that box and you're going to be there a while. So it just didn't sit well at all. But again, in prison, a lot of things don't sit well. Sometimes your dinner doesn't sit well, but you know these things are out of your control, and you just have to just kind of get through it the best you can. You know, after 10, 12 days, Goon Squad did their little investigation, and the autopsy came back, and they took me down to classification in C-section and told me they were going to cut me loose because there's no, you know, evidence that any, you know, wrongdoing went on at all. Then when I went back, they, you know, of course they wanted all this property and all that stuff, so I had to go through, like, his personal property, his beanie cap and his ID card and, you know, like his comb that he used all the time. It was just really kind of sobering. It was really, when you're handling somebody who's no longer with us stuff and it still kind of has their smell, you know what I mean? It's just weird. You know, the TVs were still on, the fans were still on. They've been running for like 10 days in there. It was different, and I stayed in that cell. I lived in that cell. You know, I got rid of all the bedding, his pillows, and just all that stuff because I didn't want it around me. You know, I just felt like it was a little too close. I painted the cell afterwards and, you know, cleaned it all up, and it still, I would still, like, it's strange because when somebody disappears like that, and after you've been with them for a long time, you're so used to them being in there that even though you're not looking at them, you can kind of feel that they're there, and I felt a little bit of that, you know, and then, you know, reality set in, and I knew he had gone. I always thought, well, you know, should I have went against his wishes when I saw that he was getting sick, if I should have, you know, gone against what he wanted and get him some help if he would still be alive. And, you know, looking back on it, I think it was over. That's not something that I dwell on. The only thing that I really look back on and remember was his smile and the way that he said, you know, at least I won't be standing for count no more. It gets to be Halloween, and I think about him. I've lost many friends, lifers, cancer, a couple guys with cancer, Ricky Earl, Andy Levitt. These are all guys that I did a lot of time with. And they got sick and died and left with it. You know, Tony was the only one that I actually saw in my cell. But, you know, the loss of a good friend. He was a good guy. You know, everybody's got their faults. But, I mean, there was a reason I'd lived with him for so long. And it was because he was really a decent human being. When you lose somebody like that, you think it's
you know, it's no big deal. Everything's going to be okay. But, you know, it's like, it's some of the weirdest times, because we used to sit and eat dinner at the same table in the chow hall. You know how we're programmed, we sit in the same place. And yeah, one day I was just sitting there, and man, I just started shedding tears. And I hope nobody had seen me, you know, but it was starting to really set in that he was gone, and that there was a part of my life that was no longer going to be the same. Tony Ogle was his name, C11133.
Last Count was reported by Greg Eskridge and edited by Jess Angbertson, with sound design and production by Jonathan Hirsch. We want to thank the journalists with the San Quentin Prison Report and David Jassy for providing additional production support for our story. Special thanks to Lieutenant Sam Robinson and Larry Schneider with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Our post-production editors are Kirsten Jesuits-Heidel and Rachel Kane. Danny Bringer was our engineer. If you like stories about the law but have gotten tripped up by the legal system, tune into Life of the Law on iTunes. We tell stories about the law like it is. Stories about block bosses who give out hugs and slugs, attorneys with 1-800 numbers and ads on TV at 3 a.m., and lawyers negotiating ownership of mineral rights on asteroids. Take a few minutes to post your review of Life of the Law on iTunes, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. We're a nonprofit project of the Tide Center, and we're part of the Panoply Network of podcasts from Slate. You can also find Life of the Law on PRX, Public Radio Exchange. We're funded by the Open Society Foundations, the Law and Society Association, the National Science Foundation, the Proteus Fund, the Ford Foundation, and by you. Visit our website, lifeofthelaw.org, and make a much-appreciated donation to pay for the direct costs of producing our episodes. It just takes a minute. Next on Life of the Law.
Fortunately, I didn't have any time to sit in front of the television, because if I did, the TV ad was on every station, cable, network, nonstop, all the time for 10 days. It was, you know, carpet bombing by TV ad.
That's next on Life of the Law. I'm Nancy Mullane. Thanks for listening.